with our definitions. And ready for the next slide, please. To sort of take a page out of Mark Twain quoting Benjamin Disraeli, I like to think of lies, damn lies, and statistical access networks. We have a period in our development as an industry where the hyperbole and promotional hype on so many fronts from so many contending voices to try and promote their position or defend their position has just spiraled out of control. It is unbelievable to me as an insider in this industry how poorly we have done to educate our public, both the investment community, the intellectual property community, the carrier community. How in the world can anyone make a decision with the noise floor being as high as it is right now and the facts being so distorted and few and far between? I get asked all the time, so what's your data rate? This Adaptive stuff sounds cool. What's your data rate? And that is a multivariate question. It doesn't have an answer. It has many, many, many answers. Depends on what modulation scheme the Adaptive system currently is functioning at for an individual user terminal A, terminal B, C, through N. And as the system matures and is populated up by more and more users, obviously enough, like all wireless systems, the available capacity and bandwidth has to be factored in by how many users are on the system contending for that bandwidth, where they're located under the footprint of that antenna, and indeed what type of service are they seeking to have deployed at that moment. We all remember the early hype around 3G cellular. 2.4 megabits a second, they would say, and never finished the sentence. The sentence should have continued per sector for all the users contending for that bandwidth under that sector. And yes, that's resulted in the next problem, which I'd like to highlight here, which, what is broadband? For an awful long time, the IEEE defined broadband as greater than 1.544 megabits of throughput. Wideband, 64 kilobits to 1.544, and narrowband services less than 64 kilobits. But we live in a world where, due to some rather creative interpretations of what broadband means, we now are describing the low end of wideband as broadband. And if that doesn't add to the noise and the confusion, I don't know how anybody's going to figure out what's the true baseline with which we are going to establish that missing data Erlang that our network proponents and service providers simply struggle with on a case-by-case basis today. We have Doug Lockie here on the panel from Gigabeam. What in the world is gigabit Ethernet wireless? It's beyond broadband. And these definitional challenges continue to be one of our principal responsibilities as an industry to address. But to the fun part, as we start to bring these services to market, we have extraordinary challenges to face on many, many fronts. Public policy is literally years behind technology. We have challenges in how spectrum is allocated and licensed. It's a cumbersome, expensive, and slow process in most jurisdictions. In many parts of the world, the spectrum allocations are tied to specific technologies, not even allowing carriers or service providers to make their own technical decisions about what they might think would be the most optimal technology to employ. We have the local zoning challenges, extraordinary pushback in many jurisdictions around the world where people are absolutely convinced through whatever superstitious concepts they have about wireless that cell tower that's located next to their apartment building is going to cause cancer for all of their children. It has been a real challenge to get the not in my backyard problem addressed. It has become an extremely expensive part of the overall cost of deployment for carriers trying to deploy wireless networks around the world. In addition, we now have a very mature cellular industry. We have deep market penetration, very advanced ecosystems, and huge capital investments made around the world in traditional legacy voice cellular, trying to move into more data-centric services, but still largely a network that extends off the legacy circuit switch network and was never designed to be a broadband telecosm-type pure packet broadband-to-the-edge network. The operators of those legacy networks, and specifically the legacy incumbent ILEC, have been waging a rather, I would think from a legal perspective and a regulatory perspective, a masterful rear guard action. We've recently seen something that I'm very happy about, which is the redaction of the mandatory resale of the DSL lines by the ILEC, piggybacking on the Supreme Court's cable modem decision, that for the first time, my customers now actually have a reason that they have to go buy dedicated bypass facilities. So we're happy about that. But also you find extraordinary disruption and blurring of traditional service provider boundaries and regulatory environments. You've got the telcos moving into the video distribution arena historically controlled by the cable operators who have been paying franchise fees on a jurisdictional by jurisdictional basis. The blurring of wireline, wireless fixed, mobile access, and content, the types of business models that the various service providers have historically relied on, whether they were paid for metered service by the minute or flat bundled services for access, all of those things are now under significant review and attack by a wide range of new competitors providing new types and kinds of services. So as we look at the various operators that are out there today, I believe the mobile operators from the traditional cellular industry are extremely well positioned to be fast followers of these next generation WiMAX type or broadband wireless packet networks. They can leverage their existing facilities quite handsomely, but I do not believe they are going to be the leaders that are going to get out there and take the points. What you will find is disenfranchised major telcos such as Korea Telecom, China Netcom, Chinatel, other major national carriers who have become disenfranchised from owning their wireless assets through various spin-offs or other regulatory evolutions, who are desperately interested in getting back into wireless. Wibro, which is basically a subset of 802.16e circa February of this year, is a reality in Korea. Korea Telecom and SKT have both paid for and received their licenses. Both of them are in early trial stages with manufacturers. Samsung, LGE, Nortel, and POS Data currently are the three contenders for the Korea Telecom build. You've got a wellspring of opportunities for this new technology to find real-world places to prove up its veracity. And hopefully, a year from now, when we convene here again, the hyperbole in the marketplace will have been replaced by real-world experience from skeptical analysts and investors who have given a good, hard due diligence look to how these systems actually perform in the real world. Cablecos, many of the cable infrastructure operators are struggling to upgrade to two-way cable. Smaller market and second and third-tier players clearly look to wireless as a way to both add triple play services for broadband internet and VoIP, as well as provide white space fill-in to underserved markets. And then there's a very huge and very seldom discussed opportunity in the private network world. Public safety, video monitoring has become an extraordinarily important topic for most municipalities around the world on the back of the London Tube bombings. We have seen many initiatives now to increase bandwidth in a pure IP shared environment or in a dedicated private network environment for first responders in a large number of countries around the world. So why WiMAX? In a world where we have numerous cellular standards, 3GPP and UMTS, leading forward from a decades-long evolution, clearly you might think of WiMAX, as I think of at least the 802.16e mobility version, is 4G cellular. When we all get together in Geneva in 2008 and start arguing about what 4G really is, it's my contention that the in numbers of millions of subscribers on Wibro and WiMAX systems that will be live by that time will be a very powerful voice in that room. OFDMA is looking to be the direction most sophisticated service providers and manufacturers believe this will evolve. One of the interesting things that's happened in our industry, too, is the cost of the electronics for infrastructure is now entering a zone where it's less expensive than the cost of the civil work and the legal and regulatory work needed to get the site permit set up. The best cell sites have been taken, and the expense of deploying networks and maintaining networks in the legacy cellular environment is simply going to be unsustainable in the broadband IP world, which leads us from the plug-and-play user terminal part of this current phenomenon, where we take the truck roll out of installing new customers, which historically equals one truck roll, 1 year profit for each customer, into an environment where we'll now have plug-and-play base stations as well. Base stations that, as new emitters are put into service around them, they can immediately notify back to the network operations center that they have dynamically discovered new interference, in real time manage that interference, but also avoid the problem of historically having to have drive testing and continuous tuning of the network with a manual labor force. So I think, as I mentioned earlier, OFDMA TDD is what is appearing to be the platform that's going to carry the day. As we move forward, I'll, in the interest of time, move forward here quickly. And some of the things that will be a byproduct of this that we have all looked to enjoy that we have not had access to previously. Historically, cellular carriers have had a sticky relationship with you, their customers, through the handset. One of the big byproducts of the new WiMAX initiatives and mobile WiMAX specifically is that for the first time you are going to see an environment where you very likely take control of your ownership of your access device, and you will churn carriers in multiple stratified networks delivering all kinds of interesting products that you may want to take advantage of, but you will control from whom do you take what service at what time. That's not to say there won't still be additional business models that embrace this subsidized model, but I do believe you're going to find a lot of higher value-added opportunities that emerge out of this evolution than those we've seen previously. Thank you.
Join us in welcoming Frank DiLupo, CEO and Director of AMedia Networks.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be speaking here today. This is my first conference, and hopefully won't be my last. I'd like to spend some time today telling you a bit about AMedia Networks, but more importantly, about our mission. And our mission is to deliver a fully dedicated point-to-point 100 megabit signal to homes and businesses throughout the world. And let me tell you a little bit about how we will be doing this. I'm not going to discuss applications a lot. I think we can all envision what type of applications can be provided over 100 megabit stream into your home. But there are certainly some things that can be done and can be done, I think, uniquely through a point-to-point Ethernet solution. One, of course, is through a single interface. We can provide voice, video, and data through one unit rather than have a multitude of units, as David Huber mentioned this morning. We do this through a combination of products, and I'll talk to you about that in just a moment. In addition, we feel it's extremely important to have a fully symmetrical 100 megabit system. Many of the competitive technologies that are out there today don't provide a symmetrical solution. That is, there's a good deal of bandwidth coming into home, but somewhat limited bandwidth leaving home. And we think that that's a constraint that will limit the number of applications going forward. We think it's important to be able to do this on both fiber and copper. As I'll mention in a few moments, there are a number of constraints that service providers deal with, different business cases that they have to work within, that limit their opportunity to drive fiber all the way to the home immediately, but instead would like to drive fiber as deeply as they can into the network, transition to copper, and at some later date, upgrade that home or business to fiber. And we think that through a switched Ethernet solution, you can do that very effectively. We also feel that hardening, providing a carrier class solution, of course, is equally important to these points I just made before, because carriers will not deploy something that isn't of carrier class grade. That is, the products will meet some of the harsh specs that deal with outside placement of equipment in addition to quality of service guarantees. In our case, much of our technology was licensed from Lucent Technologies. Many of the team had come from Lucent. Many of us were aware of this technology. Lucent had been interested in licensing not only this technology, but several technologies over the last few years, and we grabbed the opportunity to take this license and run with it. And what we think is necessary for success in this market is to provide a very flexible but yet very comprehensive solution. And as I mentioned, I think it begins with a symmetrical 100 megabits signal. And we feel that this will broaden the number of opportunities, particularly as you look at some of the things that we demonstrated recently at Supercom. We actually took a high-definition video camera, which are now in the market. Just a couple months ago, they were selling for about $2,500, and I think we were just told the other day they've now dropped below $2,000. It'd only be a matter of time, months, maybe a year before these things will be as handy as the small cameras we carry around today. This operates at an MPEG-2 compression rate, and we actually showed the audience as they passed by the booth in high definition on a monitor on the other side of the exhibit. And what was truly remarkable is the quality, of course, of high definition as you apply it, perhaps, to video conferencing. Again, as David Huber mentioned this morning, the video conferencing is a big part of our future, we believe, particularly as travel is going to become more constrained due to fuel prices and a host of other things. So this particular image, you can actually walk up to it and you can read a business card. You can read that fine print on a business card. It takes 20 megabits of upstream bandwidth to provide that type of a service. So we think the upstream bandwidth will be as important as the downstream. Point-to-point provides a very secure network. In our case, each of the devices that we deploy at the residence or in the business, it has its own unique MAC address, as does, as would any Ethernet solution, point-to-point Ethernet solution. Therefore, the only packets that are arriving to that residence or business are those that are addressed. And that's, therefore, it's not like a broadcast and select system where the possibility of piracy might be greater. We think bandwidth services are critically important, quality of service. Multiple levels of quality service are critically important to providing a good quality service from a service provider. In our case, we run the full gamut from best effort all the way up to guaranteed quality of service. We think Ethernet will actually rise to a new level as more quality of service guarantees are provided through this type of technology. Simplified operations are certainly possible. There are no engineering limits, rules limits that kind of constrain the model as you deploy these systems. Since it is point-to-point, it is very easy to engineer and also very easy to maintain. Again, I mentioned quality of grade. It has to be reliable whatever you deploy. And finally, we think that Ethernet over copper using VDSL2 provides a significant amount of bandwidth, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. As I said, there are different models, though, that are out there. I mean, not everyone can conform to the same business case. There are a lot of things that vary in terms of what type of environment the equipment is actually going into. Needless to say, each service provider today, whether here in the United States or outside the United States, has to deal with different geographical densities and customer profiles. As clearly in the northeastern part of the United States, the communities are very tight-knit. The distances to serve those communities is not very great. So therefore, you can provide a business case in that environment might be quite different than a case where, out here in the far west where the loops are extremely long. Each of these carriers also have different views on the pace of demand growth, exactly how fast our high bandwidth service is going to be required. So those have to be factored into any business case that they arrive at. All have different exposures to competition. Clearly, the major service providers are feeling a great deal of competition, not only from the cable providers, but also from satellite. And therefore, they have to factor that into their business case. But they all have to do something. I think they all recognize that they have to move from a 2 megabit DSL and cable modem solution to something much higher. So, we think that these different business cases require not only fiber to the premise, but more likely fiber to the X. That is, fiber to the premise, fiber to the node, to the curb, and finally to the building. But what I think we can all agree on is that it's a huge market, both here inside the United States and outside the United States. So we think a switched Ethernet solution provides a great deal of flexibility. And let me try to take you through a few things that I think are very important. First we see a migration from the small central offices that permeate this country and other countries around the world to a much larger regional central offices that will in fact house all the necessary equipment to provide triple play services. Things like an IP video server, of course, a PSTN gateway for that traffic that does get routed to the PSTN, a very critical piece of the new, you know, the network of the future will be a significantly sized layer three core switch supported by a gateway to the internet, and then finally a soft switch that will manage this entire network. Over on the right-hand side there, we have a product we call the AS5000. It's a Layer 2 switch. You'll see it on a number of these drawings. But one of the first applications that we think is made possible by point-to-point Ethernet is that, in fact, with the price of copper coming down as dramatically as it has in recent years, as low as 1 centimeter in China, we feel that you can, in fact, do home-run fiber runs to either the homes or businesses served. That is, you don't need to have a shared fiber out to the neighborhood and then split it into a split of 16 or 32. In this case, where you have a dedicated fiber, there's nothing in the outside plant. Everything is buried until it comes up to the wall of the home or business served. So you eliminate all the extraneous equipment that's out there today, whether you're providing a switched Ethernet or a PON solution. And, of course, in a solution like that, that is a symmetrical 100 megabits because your bandwidth is virtually unlimited on a fiber connection. Another application that adds to the flexibility of a solution like this is that you can, in fact, run some 50 kilometers to a switch, as I just mentioned, that is hardened and can be put out in the harsh environment. And then from there, you can run yet another 50 kilometers to the homes or businesses served. So, again, if you have a large regional central office, you can provide a 90-kilometer reach and deliver a fully symmetrical 100 megabits, over that medium. In addition, you can once again place that layer 2 switch out in the neighborhood. And in this case, you can transition from fiber. You drive fiber all the way, either within 5,000 feet of that neighborhood being served, or as close as 500 feet in a fiber-to-the-curb solution. And through that method, you can transition then to VDSL2. And at VDSL2, I think you can conservatively say today that you can deliver 25 megabits out to about 5,000 feet, and as much as a fully symmetrical 100 megabits at 500 feet. We're now running almost 120 megabits in the lab over 500 feet of twisted pair, traditional Cat3 cable. And we've run as much as 74 megabits over 1,000 feet of twisted pair. Making this even more intriguing is that at a later date, you can take that VDSL2 card and remove it from that shelf and upgrade that home to fiber by replacing that card with a fiber card and changing the residential gateway inside the home. And now that home can be serviced over fiber without changing the electronics that are out in the cabinet. A big savings and a significant continuing reduction in CapEx savings. Another very intriguing application is where you have multi-dwelling units. Many 24% of the residents of this country live in multi-dwelling units, whether garden-type apartments or high-rise apartments. And in that case, what could be done is a layer 2 switch could be placed in the basement of that building or in the proximity of a garden, in the center of a garden-type apartment complex, and drive fiber all the way to that building, and then transition to VDSL2. And as I mentioned before, you can then run you can run 500 megabits up the building riser that's in there today, not requiring that building owner to come in and replace that twisted pair with fiber. And by the way, that's a fully symmetrical 100 megabits, so why even replace the copper anytime soon? So, that is a significant advantage. By the way, a switch like this could also support Cat5 in that riser as well through a simple change in the WAN interface on the unit. An added value is also in Ethernet, as you know, you can provide redundancy through link aggregation, spanning tree features that can be placed on these layer 2 switches. So through the correct array of these layer 2 switches, you can then provide complete redundancy on the service to those buildings. So in conclusion, we feel that switched Ethernet provides not only a dedicated 100 megabit signal, but does it in a very flexible manner that enables you to initially use copper where necessary, whether it's twisted pair or Cat5, and then gracefully or elegantly upgrade to fiber at a later date, and providing a very economic and very high bandwidth service that will lead to many of the applications that we all think about so frequently as these networks evolve. Thank you very much.
Please welcome Dave Schaefer, CEO of Cogent Communications.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, George, for having me.
Maybe a little different than Jay. I didn't bring somebody to keep me out of trouble, and since I have no slides, I'll get my own safe harbor. With that, let me kind of touch on a few points. I'm going to disagree with some folks that have been up here earlier today, probably starting with the price of bandwidth. Our view is the price of bandwidth will continue to fall perpetually at the rate of about 50% per year, as it has been doing over the past several years. That may sound like bad news to people in the audience. It's actually good news because there is still demand elasticity. And what we are seeing is new applications being developed that were not even contemplated in telecosms of 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. You know, this is an industry that has undergone the most radical shift and change of any industry in the United States over the past 10 years or in the world. We've seen over $3.5 trillion of wealth destroyed in telecosm. You say that's bad news, but it's actually resulted in an increase in productivity in our economy of nearly 100 basis points. So when you look at productivity of individuals or the economy in general, you can attribute roughly 1% of that real economic growth to the advent of wide area networking and the exchange of traffic. Now, as we approach the telecosm, we at Cogent have built out the world's largest IP network, in part by taking advantage of some of this turmoil that's existed within the industry, acquiring 13 companies that raised over $14 billion in capital and had market capitalizations, those that were public, of over $30 billion. Companies whose names you may be familiar with, like PSINet, Allied Rise, Carrier One, Verio, and some smaller companies. Integrating these into the largest single IP network in the world, the second largest carrier of internet traffic in the world today. But yet we're only connected to about 1,000 locations. And you say, well, how can you do that? How can you build a network that carries that much traffic? We are carrying, on a sustained average basis, about 250 gigabits of traffic across our network. That is only exceeded today by MCI's network. We're seeing traffic growth on net quarter one to quarter two. We experienced 28.5% sequential growth in traffic, applying about a 250% per year growth in traffic. While the internet in general is growing at probably between 80 and 100%, we, I think, are a testament to the fact that very aggressive pricing can, in fact, generate additional demand and help us gain market share. We select where we connect our network to. We connect to all of the Equinixes in North America. We connect today to over 220 carrier-neutral co-location facilities and about 800 multi-tenant, very large facilities where we connect to high bandwidth generating organizations that generate or consume about half of the world's internet traffic passing through those locations. It's a very targeted model. Now, to George's point, you know, why can't we be like Korea or maybe Italy, where we see everybody getting this type of broadband connectivity? And the reality is other technologies, whether they be adoptions of copper-based technology or wireless technologies, will not be able to deliver the infinitely scalable capacity of a fiber network. The challenge, however, is the cost of building that fiber network is directly proportional to the number of entities you pass. Your revenue is proportional to the entities you serve. The incumbent, unfortunately, has an advantage over a competitor in that market, forcing a competitor to clean skin the market and go after only those highest bandwidth producing locations. So today we have 8,900 miles of metro fiber, 182 operational rings, 35 markets, United States and Western Europe. That's interconnected with a long-haul network of 22,000 route miles that extends from Seattle, Washington, to Vienna, Austria, from Copenhagen, Denmark, down to Miami. But it is this very targeted approach of where we provide our termination that allows us to cost-effectively deploy fiber into those facilities. Today, it is still a world of haves and have-nots, where the business models that need high bandwidth have to concentrate in these locations. We heard that earlier from Equinix. It's very difficult for you to build a proprietary data center and then all that traffic to one of these major interexchange points. A great business model of creating the airports where that traffic can coalesce. However, as the world shifts, as information technology is democratized, peer-to-peer computing becomes much more prevalent. In that world, we now have to seek a different paradigm. As we take the concentrated server technology that exists only in a handful of locations, perhaps 200 or 300 locations globally that are massive aggregation points for this traffic, and then come up with business models that distribute that much closer to the endpoints and to the consumers. We've seen companies like Verizon take a much bolder approach where they are actually going to begin to deploy fiber to compete primarily with the cable companies with proprietary content. The ultimate power of the telecosm is not a service provider selecting and organizing the content that any one customer is going to view, but rather thousands and millions of producers of content being able to then distribute that content to millions and billions of consumers at light speed. That's really where we need to head, and we need to look at how we bridge the gaps in the network. There is virtually no more capital being deployed in competitive providers. You know, as we look at an industry that has gone through massive destruction of wealth and the redeployment of those assets, there is still surplus capacity in the network at the core. Today, as I said, we are operating the world's largest IP network. Our North American IP-only network is at least at every location 80 gigabits of intercity traffic. We deploy into each building anywhere from 2 to 40 gigabits of bandwidth into any one location. We, however, are only utilizing 3% of the traffic that we've deployed in our network, and there's still a myriad of other service providers out there. With that much overcapacity at the core of the network, we must see new models to bring more traffic onto the network. Different than in a voice-based network where there is no more demand elasticity. Our industry is one that revolves around the revenues generated from voice. Today, still 70% of all telecommunications revenues come from voice services, down from 95% probably 5 years ago, but yet that revenue is being generated by less than 0.1% of the bits carried on the network. The voice networks are ones that are ultimately doomed to declining economics. And we're seeing the consolidation and the reorganization of that industry, the disintermediation of the switching network and the customer service level from the network level with companies like Vantage and a number of voice over IP service providers. So today, for example, we have over 30 different voice over IP providers that lie in our network, yet we have chosen not to be a VoIP carrier. We have over 50 cable companies that distribute content over our network, hundreds of PTTs, over 400 universities that lie in our network. And the idea is that the applications and the bandwidth generating applications need to exist at the edge of the network. And the cost structure of the optronics is such that they can continue to drive down the price per bit delivered. And what we need to do is push that closer and closer to the end producer of that content. We spoke earlier, and I've heard a couple of presentations around quality of service. What you're really stating when you say that you need to build QoS into your network, if you've built a network that can't carry every bit all the time, or you've built a network that can't switch or route every bit all of the time, meaning your routing fabric is blocked,
Well, you have to look at data and how it reads the PC or any device. For better or worse, 99% of all data that reads any computing device reads over Ethernet interface. Today, Ethernet can support a variety of different packet sizes, but looking at the worst case where you had 64 bits in a packet, so you're processing the maximum number of packets, it is affordable today to build routing technology that can process those packets at wireline speed. So it is not a requirement of the network to differentiate good packets from bad, high priority packets from low priority packets, but rather over-provision the network by throwing bandwidth at the problem and delivering to end users the quality of service that they expect. So we are in a world where last mile is important. It is a world, for regulatory reasons and for capital markets reasons, that is bifurcated, and if anything, that gap is growing. While there are a number of interim technologies that are designed to reduce that bifurcation, ultimately it is a world where fiber connectivity is a necessary prerequisite to be able to deliver the highest bandwidth and really the infinite opportunities that that bandwidth can produce.
Thanks a lot, Dave, and everybody. We're also joined by Bo Beck of Ergo Networks, which is a young, innovative wireless technology company, and we'll hear more from them in another panel this afternoon as well. But please get your questions ready. We've got some time to talk about these interesting and diverse last-mile questions. Dave, let me come right back to you just to start. How did the mergers of Verizon and MCI and SBC and AT&T affect your business? Obviously, there's been lots of consolidation. You've been a big part of that, but these are going to be giant companies now.
Much larger scale. I think there's a couple of messages here. First of all, telecommunications, particularly providing IP-based services, is a commodity business. In order to be a survivor in a commodity business, you need to have the lowest cost structure. You need the lowest cost of capital, the lowest cost of operations, you need your efficiency per employee, and your efficiency per network element. And then finally, you need to have a successful sales and marketing strategy, because for a competitive carrier, the biggest single cost is the cost of acquiring customers. We've seen an industry that is consolidating. Ultimately, telecommunications is a natural monopoly. Competition exists in this industry for only two reasons. Either the regulators come in and force competition, or guess what? They've gotten tired and gone home. And, all they care about now is what Howard Stern says on Sirius Radio, and they're not really forcing competition in last mile or in network deployment. And secondly, capital can come in and create an unnatural state, create a competitive environment. Well, those external drivers have gone away. Our industry is consolidating. It's consolidating three ways, Brett. One, companies are just going out of business. They're just disappearing. Secondly, companies are combining, such as MCI and Verizon, AT&T and SBC. Sprint and Nextel is wireless companies. And third, you're seeing companies become more focused on specific niche markets and quietly exit certain aspects of the business. Part of the business we operate in, those bulk commoditized IP transit services that Jay put a slide up earlier and showed some price decline, and I would argue that prices are still declining, probably even at an accelerating rate, is one that many carriers, like a Verizon MCI, don't want to play in. Their cost structure is such that they just don't want to be in that business. So we're seeing a horizontal segmentation in the industry. You'll see those companies focus more on their competition with the cable companies as they try to get the consumers.
John Doe, talked a little bit about the driving application. I think you mentioned teleconferencing, right? And that being a driving use, particularly high-definition conferencing. So there's an application that potentially could suck up some of this capacity, create different market conditions, maybe support the pricing argument that was made earlier. What other kinds of applications do you see on a collaborative basis that would exist to drive increased usage of the deployed capacity?
Yeah, one chart that I didn't use today that I think we get a lot of comments about is that, for instance, a high-definition film, digitally encoded, and delivered to your home at 100 megabits, takes 23 minutes. 23 minutes to get that film into your home, into a DVR. So I guess you could argue 23 minutes is better than, you know, 2 or 3 days, as it would take at 56 kilobits, which is exactly what it would take. So, but it is, at least the film at least the film is in your home before it finishes. So there's one example of where, you know, 100 megabit stream could be very helpful. At a gig, it's only 2 minutes to get that film into your home. In addition, you know, we feel that gaming is, although I don't know that we still have our arms around exactly what the impact that gaming will have, but given the interest it seems to have in the Far East, to the point, if I read recently, I think that in Japan, 25% of the backbone network of backbone capacity is now being involved in some sort of gaming. Some ridiculous number. And so we think that, you know, clearly, you know, the gaming as it approaches high definition levels, as it is right now, I think one of the gaming companies just announced that early next year they're going to be introducing their high definition version of their gaming, and that often is interactive. So there's a couple of examples in addition to the video conferencing I was talking about before. Now, clearly, you know, I think IPTV. I personally believe IPTV is going to be the next disruptive technology in our lives. I look back on what was life before email and, you know, what was life before cellular, but I do believe that IPTV will be extremely disruptive. The notion that you can get any content on any subject from perhaps anywhere in the world delivered to your home in as little as 23 minutes at 100 megabits is an intriguing idea, and what it will do to the way we live our lives going forward could be quite remarkable. But IPTV is also at 19 megabits per high definition set. is a pretty high bandwidth a service. Even at MPEG-4, it's going to be in the neighborhood of 8 megabits. So there's a good deal of bandwidth. I think applications that are out there, if the last mile makes it possible.
Frank, I know you don't want to speak for the Bell telephone companies, although they might be good customers of yours. Can you estimate what percentage of the U.S. market, you know, say 5-7 years from now, can or will be served by at least fiber, you know, to the neighborhood, or fiber to the node, if not fiber to the home, versus homes that are still served by Super DSL from your neighbor right next to you there?
Well, I don't know exactly what the deployment schedule will be, but I mean, from everything I've heard from talking to these folks, is that, you know, their plan is to be extremely aggressive in whichever method of deployment they've chosen. It's no secret that Verizon, of course, has decided to go fiber to the home. It's also no secret that they're going after some of the high revenue customers initially, and it may take them some time to get down to the to what they would characterize as the lower revenue customers. I also think that SBC and Bell South are going to become very aggressive. And in fact, you know, the severe damage down in the Gulf area may open an opportunity for Bell South to even change their plan, perhaps replace much of their copper that has been to some degree destroyed down there. Although there was a little web page the other day, a little chat room that indicated that some of these technicians from Bell South did go up in the attic of some of these buildings where some of these desperate people were looking for safety, and found that analog telephone sets with the connector 15 feet underwater were still working. So I don't know how quick the copper is going to deteriorate, but the fact remains it does open an opportunity for them to replace the infrastructure with fiber. So I think in 5 years, what the percentage will be, I don't know. I maybe I guess 30-40% perhaps of a penetration of one of those types of
using one of those choices, fiber to node, curve, or fiber to the. But my guess is as good as anyone's.
Got a question for Vern and Doug and maybe Bo also. Vern, you mentioned a couple constraints on wireless deployment, one being cell sites, another being spectrum policy. I know Doug and you have been very involved in that. And I have to make an admission for George, our office in Massachusetts. We now have a tenant in our office offices who's who has a mission of on spreading the word about the cancerous effects of cell phones. And I guess they've been organizing marches to cell sites, and they've been chaining themselves to cell towers and things, which is just one of the costs that you say are driving the cost of cell.
If the telecosm goes down, he'll go up.
That's right. That's right.
So, and I'll be a prosperous real estate bank.
And so this is obviously one cost, but on a more serious note, even for those of us who, you know, deal with the telecom policy issues often, spectrum policy is a, you know, it's very complex. What should the FCC be doing right now to make sure that that more dollars are invested in wireless systems and that more people can get more diverse services over all the numerous different networks?
That's an hour. the most courageous act I've ever seen out of the FCC was Michael Powell's last day, when they took their cognitive radio idea, 3.65 to 3.7 gigahertz, and allocated 50 megahertz of auction-exempt spectrum to all the disenfranchised carriers that were looking to deliver services over wireless but who had no spectrum. This was for fixed. It wouldn't have been very high utility value for mobile. But it was a great experiment, and it has been jumped on by my own industry and my own trade association as a bad idea and bad policy. And, of course, Michael and the John Mulletta of the Wireless Radio Bureau are gone, so the champions are no longer there. It was an attempt, I think, to demonstrate just exactly how spectrum warehousing has really damaged the United States overall in terms of our participation in the global wireless revolution. Major Asian nations are executing industrial policy to drive these services into the marketplace. The Koreans had watched 802.16e, which they were largely, I should say, between Etri and Samsung, largely pushing the standards body for the mobile WiMAX, languish. And so in February of this year, they drew a line in the sand and they said, okay, that's good enough for us. Made a few tweaks to make a Korean domestic policy fix, if you will, a 9 megahertz channels with 1 megahertz guard bands instead of 10 megahertz channels. Big deal. Everything else is virtually identical to 16E. That kind of movement, largely pushed by Korea Telecom, also had industrial policy issues on their perpetual argument with Qualcomm over royalty and licensing fights. That's unique probably to Korea, where CDMA was also pioneered over a decade ago. As you move into other jurisdictions, India, actively trying to figure out how to deliver service to 200 million new users over the next 24 to 36 months. Best idea they've had so far is 2G cellular with GSM. It's not going to meet their needs for pushing the internet out for e-governance and e-education and distance learning as well as e-medicine into the disenfranchised masses there. However, on the other side of the equation, they are actively investigating and for the first time seem to have an open mind about allocating 700 megahertz spectrum, 2.3 gigahertz spectrum, which would line up with the Korean allocation of 2.3. There's 100 megahertz of spectrum in China that was set aside for TDF CDMA, the domestic Chinese 3G spectrum. That is very likely, I think, to see Korea influence the Chinese government to participate in 2.3 and modify their domestic approach, likely not to be global WiMAX, but likely to be domestic policy CHIMAX, if you will, probably a derivative of 16E as well. Around the world, those decisions are being made by other nations. In our country, We're doing it the old-fashioned way. We've got, you know, Craig McCaw, bless his heart, out there aggregating spectrum up out of the old MMDS ITFS space, you know, doing much as Dave has done on the wired side, trying to literally take and leverage a competitive position in a very challenging market. We've got Sprint now, with Sprint Nextel being merged, sitting on 180 megahertz of what's now called the BRS radio spectrum that used to be MMDS at 2.5 to 2.7. They have about 80% of that spectrum nationwide in their possession. They're extremely well positioned to leverage it, but they have so many things on their plate and so little immediate burning need to execute on that, I think it will be delayed a number of years. Canada recently made a decision to force the licensees on the legacy MMDS spectrum up there, the equivalent, we call it MCF spectrum, to move and implement. So around the world, there's plenty of spectrum. In the United States, there's also plenty of spectrum, but most of it's sequestered. My personal belief is the government should actively push auction-exempt, first-come, first-served spectrum into the marketplace, not to compete with cellular, but for broadband fixed wireless access, and then drastically get involved with refarming the below 2 and below 3 gigahertz spectrum from mobile. Sorry, long-winded.
Oh, that's great. Thanks.
Doug?
I'd carry that a step forward and put a ribbon around it. If you look at the physics, what we should be doing is moving towards taking DC to 7 gigahertz and making that for wireless, both nomadic and mobile, because it lends itself to being ubiquitous and getting through trees and brush and all the houses, and it lends itself to mobility, and that's probably the highest and best view. DC to up to 7 gigahertz, which is a little bit beyond what Wi-Fi spectrum is today, which stops around 5.8. But from the physics of the situation, that penetrates well. And the FCC has made some huge strides and continues. A lot of the initiative stopped when Chairman Powell left. But Paul Kowalski, who came out of DARPA, led the charge in there about software-defined or cognitive radios that listen and sense what's not being used and how you can use it. We all thought it'd be years and years, tens of years, before that really happened. Vern, we just deployed Vern's Adaptic system the other day in Tulsa, and it was an out-of-the-box, no truck roll installation of both the base station and the user premises on a portable tower. And I'll talk a little more about that in the break session later. But people are doing these cognitive radios. They're doing them today, and I think the industry as a whole goes in and legislates for the FCC. My experience with those guys is that there's a lot of dedicated civil servants in there, and a lot of them are really smart, and we keep moving in this direction and show that industry is moving towards cognitive radios. They will work hard at opening up that chunk of spectrum for that highest best use.
Can you do a quick definition of cognitive radio? Somebody might not know.
A cognitive radio is one that senses the environment, and any spectrum that's not being used, it says, I can go ahead and use that. Now, you've got this collision sense problem to deal with, but it's a solvable problem. Just for those of you who are electrical engineers in the audience, also you could say, well, this is impossible. You can't build a radio that can do the RF tuning, the filtering from DC through 7 gigahertz. But there's a couple of companies in Silicon Valley that are actually working on 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 million high-Q filters implemented on silicon, a form of nanotechnology, using tuning fork resonators. And it's funny how when one door closes, another one opens in the technology world, but I think that we will see practical DC to 7 gigahertz smart front ends that can adapt to the electronics that are behind them in the next few years. So, a ribbon around that, press with the FCC to point out to them the technology of solving the problem, and press with them for the highest and best use of the spectrum.
Question. What about our other panelists who haven't spoken yet today? Comments on any of these areas. Bo, what's your view on some of these wireless questions we've been talking about?
Well, at Ergo Networks, we're focused on Wi-Fi compatible products, so we operate in the
spectrum that are allocated to us, so we're not out there fighting with the FCC for a lot of that. I mean, we have our own battles and our places to fight, but I think as people move forward, and traditionally most of the products out there in the marketplace are in the 2.4 gigahertz range for the 802.11b and the G products, and they went off and allocated the 5 gigahertz spectrum, but they threw the party and nobody came. It was more expensive to do. A lot of companies just couldn't do it, period. It's the transition, I think, is a lot slower than a lot of people have anticipated, and I think the pain threshold and the congestion in the more limited 2.4 gigahertz range has not quite reached the level of seriousness that has forced people to fight the bullet and go up.
When do you think that will happen?
Well, I think it's in the applications that are going to really drive much more wide usage of Wi-Fi for real critical applications like IPTV distribution around the house and things like that. And as you start to really run into you and your neighbor and everyone else all contending over 3 channels and 2.4 gigahertz, the argument for having a radio that's going to be able to operate in 11 channels of a 5 gigahertz range would be a very compelling sort of no-brainer. And I think that's going to really help it. Up to now, the only people really been deploying 11A type solutions are sort of enterprise networks, or people who kind of have control over both ends, because otherwise you're always kind of on one side and not the other. Of course, Intel is now shipping ABG with their single product. So, that's have an effect over time.
John, you've got students and engagements in a variety of companies doing wireline, wireless, all these various technologies. What do you think, how do you think it's going to break down? Is there going to be lots of broadband wireless point-to-point to homes and offices, or is it mostly going to run over wires, or what are the prospects that Verizon actually will complete a significant proportion of its fiber to the home program? How do you sort out these various technologies?
I heard two questions. The first was the wireless, and the second was the penetration of the fiber. On the wireless, what I tell the students all the time, that's proved true in my quarter century of working, is that wireless works well where there are no wires. And where there is a wire to compete against, wireless won't compete well. We all know with our cell phones dropping the service and such, and that fundamentally is always going to be with us for wireless, but it's got an enormous future. And at the ends of the wires, where we have to want mobility, or we want the feasibility of putting the computer anywhere in the house or the TV anywhere in the house, that will be a big winner, of course, in that sense. In terms of the fiber to the home, I've been involved in this since 1979. Every 5 years I've heard that there's going to be an aggressive build-out of fiber to the home, and I'm still waiting. And in the meantime, the DSL systems have grown to about 130 million of them in the world. It's a $20-30 billion industry, still in its early stages, and I think it will do quite well. I would not disagree with the 30 or 40% penetration of customers, but probably all of those connections, or
what
nearly
the,
all,
what,
will 40? Have some copper at the end.
Oh, yeah. What's the 40% penetration?
That's what Frank had suggested 5 years from now in terms of where the broadband, what percentage of the U.S. would have, I think, broadband.
Although I would like to comment on it, because I do think that, we really only have to look at the cable companies to get an appreciation of what the necessary effort, if the necessary effort is applied, can be accomplished. I mean, I don't know when coax first started being deployed in this country, but it certainly wasn't too much beyond 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And in a relatively short period of time, they built an entire new network, first by driving coax all the way from a head end to our home, and then going back and revitalizing it by driving fiber all the way out and using either existing coax or replacing the coax. So, they did it, and they did it in a very aggressive fashion. They serve just about as many homes today as the telephone companies do. So I do think, as the cost, and by the way, they weren't terribly cost sensitive either. because they incurred a ton of debt in the process. But I think with fiber prices coming down, and with solutions like we provide, where the cost per door is approaching, you know, under certainly under $500 for the electronics, if not under $400, the business cases will start to prove in. The competition with the cable companies is going to be relentless, I believe, because with their net, you know, with their entry into the voice business, this has really got people deeply concerned, and I think that it will accelerate. But I agree with you. We've all been waiting for it to happen, and I do think that 40% will be some combination of fiber deep into the network and transition to twisted pair, and then eventually that twisted pair being replaced by fiber when the business case is right.
There's probably something really important to talk about in terms of fiber to the home comparison. In an urban area or suburban area, business area, it's probably $250,000 to $1 million a mile to trench in fiber because it's got to be a 3-foot deep trench. There's a lot of stuff already there. When you deploy fiber in a neighborhood, it only has to be 3 inches, 6 inches, 9 inches deep. There's probably two orders of magnitude less expense in the trenching cost in neighborhoods and bedroom community than there is in an industrial area. It'll be interesting to see if finally some of the big efforts in the next 50 years, whether there start being large fiber deployments to the bedroom community.
Question from the audience. Just very quick to make sure I heard right. You said $250,000 a mile for infrastructure.
Trench.
Fiber trench, yeah. Clearly. But even two orders of magnitude better is still $25,000 a mile. That seems hopeless.
That's free.
$25,000
in the greatest scheme of things.
That's what?
That's free.
That's $5 a foot.
There's 200 customers on that mile. It's a round-off there.
Then copper, I don't know about your house, it's 50 feet from the curb, so that's $250 for me for that trench. And in fact, I don't get the $5 rate if I get the electrician or whoever charging me 10 times that.
When you compare that to now you've got gigabits times thousands in that fiber. The net effect is that I think you're going to see everything going forward, and it's going to be more bandwidth at better cost in every kind of media that there is. The point that I was trying to make, though, is, all right, I see a few people in the audience who have heard me say at least 1,000 times, it's $1 million a mile to $250,000 a mile in a downtown area. And an observation that I've made recently is that fiber being deployed in a bedroom community is a couple of orders of magnitude lower cost, and people are doing more of it every 5 years.
Yeah, and there is a big difference between cost and aerial versus buried, too. I mean, aerial is a lot cheaper, and there's still an awful lot of aerial cable being placed in this country, so that has to be factored in there.
I think we have time for one more question.
Stephen Craig from Wave Systems. Can you comment a little bit on the fact that perhaps one of the things that's preventing the kinds of content and services from non-traditional media suppliers, like one that we know of, like a Yahoo or a Google, if we provide 100 megabits per second to every house, and Google launches their 10 million channel TV service off of every RSS feed that's out there on the planet, then the fundamental premise, which is that by laying the fiber, I can collect the service revenue. If I have no mechanism to enable and manage the subscriber relationship with the rest of the planet's media, then I might undermine the entire monopoly of the structure and payment systems that are there. So it would seem to me that one of the biggest challenges is that in opening the monopoly, you know, how do I let, once I let the internet in at very large bandwidth, I mean, today podcasting is a really good example of that. It's like the music industry's example with MP3 files, you know, where it was the first bastion because I can get good content in audio, demonstrating that everyone can deliver hours and hours and hours of programming over an RSS feed into my house, and I just need to organize it and play it, and a lot of the appliances are missing to really make that work.
RSS.
So really simple syndication is the ability to automatically pull down content to something I think is cool, you know, this conference.
So let me take a quick stab at that. First of all, the current economic model that exists day for exchanging network traffic at the backbone was
thrives in a world in which bandwidth is scarce. If you look at virtually every ISP, their networks sit on top of a network that was originally designed to carry voice telephony traffic and has been adapted to an IP network. So some of that surplus capacity was put into routers and used for IP. That model does not scale well, but the price of bandwidth has fallen precipitously as optical interfaces on routers became prevalent, the ability to build LAN-based networks. So the idea that you charge people to push across your network, which is the current transit model, may be a flawed model. If you now look at the cable industry, it's almost the exact opposite. The cable company really runs two completely separate businesses. One business is a distribution network, which I think we heard earlier, they went deep into debt. They've rebuilt twice in the past 40 years. They carry about $3,000 a sub to deploy. And my guess is none of them want to be in that business if they can help it. The second business is buying content from companies like ESPN or HBO, packaging it in such a way, and then selling it at a profit. That is clearly a much higher margin and lower barrier to entry business. As information technology becomes democratized, service providers will have to realize that they cannot offer a vertically integrated stack and therefore become the sensors of that content. So it is the realization I have a monopoly for distribution because my cost is driven by the number of homes I pass versus the number that I serve. The incumbent's got a 50% cost advantage over the cable operator. We only have 67% cable penetration in the U.S. We've got 96% wireline telephony penetration. Therefore, the phone company's got a 50% cost advantage in pulling that fiber drop on day one without any sales or marketing costs. If, however, the phone company says, okay, I'm going to become the connectivity pipe of choice, that's a great business model, but it's one that's ultimately a commodity business. What they're trying to do is get into the content management business. Phone companies haven't been particularly adept at that, and I'm not sure they will be. And to the final point that you raised, as content becomes democratized and comes from millions of different sources, that content aggregation model may reside with the advertiser, which is really what Google is betting on. In other words, they're saying, look, there's two separate businesses here. There's a content organization and aggregation business, which has actually a very low barrier to entry, but a huge barrier to entry in the second dimension, which is once I've got scale, no one else can come in behind it and replicate, but my cost to get in was relatively low. On the distribution network, what the distribution companies have to come to grips with is the fact that that's what they are, and they're not something, they're trying to become something that they're not. And our industry is still struggling.
Keep conduit, content and conduit separate. Anyway,
they're really two separate businesses.
And they are, but and the cable industry currently makes its biggest profits through its conduit services, its internet services, not its content delivery.
On a per megabit basis, that's true, George, and that's really a good indication. In a 750 megahertz hybrid fiber coax system, 744 megahertz are designed for one-way video distribution, and they get about $30 a month unless you don't buy a premium service. For the other 6 megabits that are designed for internet access, they're getting $30 a month. And they don't pay anything for the content. But that's a temporary aberration in the market, not a long-term trend.
Thank you.
Going into a refreshment break right now, and then we have a bonus technology briefing, which will be held downstairs, where Doug Lockey, President and CTO of GigaBeam, will be speaking. That will be in Emigrant Peak on the lower level, number 2. Thank you.